Welcome to Alternative Realities, a podcast about the people, strategies, and stories driving the world of alternative investments. I'm Aaron Mulvihill, and I'm pleased to be joined today by my JP Morgan Asset Management colleagues, Jed Laskovitz, Global Head of Private Markets and Customized Solutions, and Anton Pill, Head of Global Alternative Investment Solutions. We previously had both Jed and Anton on the podcast to discuss the broadening out of alternatives to a wider pool of investors and broader trends within the industry. On today's episode, we'll be discussing our 2026 Alternative Investments Outlook, a comprehensive overview of the investment themes shaping the alternatives industry across all asset classes. With over 45 contributors across the firm's $500 billion alternatives platform, the Outlook is an industry-leading document that helps investors construct portfolios for the long term. Jed, Anton, welcome back to the podcast.
It's great to be here.
Yeah.
Great. So you both lead parts of JP Morgan's alternative investment business. I'd love to talk about the 2026 Outlook that came out in early December. So maybe jumping into the outlook with yourself first, Anton. I was privileged to lead the macro section together with another 45 named authors across the business. Can you give us a little bit of insight into why does JP Morgan invest the resources to put this document together every year, and how can investors use the resource?
Yeah, look, this is one of the most exciting times of the year for us. This is a time where Jed and I get to step back, talk to our clients, talk to our investors, and look for those themes across the globe that we think are going to have a material impact over the next 12 or 18 months to the alternative landscape. And it fits naturally in how we manage money. We are very active in research as the cornerstone of how we operate. So this is a very critical time of the year, and it's something that we love sharing with our clients, especially as they're thinking about how they are going to navigate their asset allocation into 2026.
Fantastic. So jumping into the themes and the various asset classes, Jed, one of the themes that is discussed in the Outlook is this convergence of public and private markets. You lead the private markets business of JP Morgan. You've previously held senior roles within the public business. So I'd love to get your views on this. What are the implications for markets and particularly for private equity?
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's an exciting time for private and public markets. And one thing that's really important is a healthy public market is really good for private markets. And when you look at the kind of backdrop of what's gone on, you know, really since the global financial crisis, we've had basically 17 years without a recession, not counting COVID, which was really fast. So when you think about relative value across public and private, and frankly, the world is fairly expensive right now, it's really important to have a lens on both valuations and opportunities in public markets and valuations and opportunities in private markets. And given the fact that we run over $4 trillion in assets across virtually every asset class, public and private, we have a unique lens into that. Like, in addition, and this is talked about a lot, companies are staying private for longer. You know, the median time to IPO is about 14 years for a private company now. That was 5 years back in the late 90s. And now companies can fund themselves in a very deep public and private market, both credit, you know, and equity. So we're excited about this convergence. When we talk to clients about what they want, what they're looking for, they're not saying we want private markets only, we want public markets only. They want to achieve their goals. And we want to make sure we're doing a good job of looking across both of those markets to help them achieve those goals.
And by the way, they're converging in other ways too, right? Like some of the bigger private companies now are talking about moving into the public space after decades of not being public, and we've never really seen mega private companies enter the public space. They usually were quite small. So there'll be a 26 will be a very interesting time to watch those two come together.
I think I told you this, Anton. I asked LLM, what do you call a $1 trillion private company? And it came back with kilo corn, thousand billions, and dragon. So I kind of prefer
Let's go with dragon.
We'll go with dragon, but you
dragon
know, companies staying
unicorn.
Private for longer, yeah. You know, you're seeing it real time.
Staying on private equity for a minute, the secondaries market has seen tremendous growth over recent years. M&A activities picking up, IPOs picking up. What does that mean for the secondaries market?
Well, look, as Jed mentioned, look, as we're seeing this convergence between public and privates, it's not just the company ownership that's converging. We're actually beginning to see liquidity get generated around both LP stakes or stakes that people have invested in private equity funds, as well as collections of companies are beginning to trade. So these markets, often referred to as secondary markets, are just another example of how these markets are converging. We're now seeing private markets private companies, in some cases, trade almost every single day. And there's two different versions of secondary markets. You have LP-led secondary markets. Think of that as somebody who owns a stake of a fund who has to sell, and there's a very active, thriving market in that. And there's also GP-led stakes, which is where a manager may decide to bundle one or two of their or three of their assets together and actually sell that as an investment directly to investors. To me, this is all indicative of that continued convergence. We're beginning to see liquidity get generated around private companies and private stakes of funds that is providing people the ability to do asset allocation and not be fixed in a particular set of allocations that they had set maybe over 5 or 10 years ago. I also think the other thing that's happening is this is now over $250 billion market. As this is a new mechanism that can be used to actually exit your positions if you're a private equity manager. So you don't actually have to IPO. You could just bundle your private company, maybe with one or two others, and sell that as a package. There's so many people investing in private companies nowadays that these secondary markets are beginning to mimic those that you're seeing in public markets. And so measuring, for example, IPOs as a measure of success for private equity, I would argue today is actually the wrong measure. We're seeing so many people sort of sell their private companies in the private markets that there are multiple exits available. And these markets are going to continue to grow and are extraordinarily attractive for a lot of investors because it gives you the ability to get invested quickly in private companies and oftentimes with clear visibility on which companies they are. So that market's going to continue to grow and is it's super exciting to watch.
And I think it makes a lot of sense. Like, as the private markets go more mainstream, you know, $20 trillion today going to $30 trillion, you want a vibrant secondary market for liquidity. And I think that's what we're seeing, record issuance of secondaries, record issuance of continuation funds. That's not necessarily a bad thing, to kind of Anton's point. It's just creating liquidity in a deeper and broader market.
Yeah, which is particularly helpful as the market is getting broader and more accessible to investors. So flipping over to the credit side of the market now, Jed, private credit. Yields are fairly compelling, but we've had some headlines on risks. How do you look at private credit as we head into next year in terms of how should investors be positioned?
Yeah, it's a big industry. If you look across all the vehicles, the range of strategies from low risk out to higher risk and distressed, it's actually $2.5 trillion in assets. Spreads have tightened, so that premium that you get for going private over public, you know, high yield or bank loans is not as large as it used to be. It's not 3 or 4% anymore in kind of direct lending. It's, you know, probably less than 2%. There have been, you know, some headline, you know, defaults, you know, this year. I don't think there's any real signal that there's real challenges deep inside the private credit markets necessarily. But I do think whenever assets go into any asset class so fast over a short amount of time, you just have to make sure that the manager you're choosing, what you're selecting, they have the right credit research, they've done the right diligence, they know how to manage risk, they've managed through the financial crisis. Remember, I said earlier, it's been a while since we've had a real wobble. And, you know, it will come. And in categories like private credit, the spread between the top performing, called the top quartile, and the bottom quartile is very wide. And that blows out even more in periods of stress. So I think the outlook for private credit continues to be fine. I am more of an advocate of public and private, as we talked about before, because you want to do more market-driven transactions, more public transactions when valuations are there, and more private transactions when you feel like you're getting paid for it. So, positive outlook, but, you know, you've got to make sure you select the right manager. The other thing that I will say, there is a premium for complexity. So you go out to performing credit and more stress credit, you know, where you're doing bridge loans and more complex transactions. You know, those are, you know, still areas you can get, you know, 7 or 8%, you know, over base rates. You know, those are areas that I think will continue to offer attractive opportunities because there are a lot of private companies that are staying private for longer and they need funding while they're private.
Jed, moving over to real assets, both commercial real estate and infrastructure seem to be at inflection points for different reasons. How do you look at real assets as we head into 2026 and what are the opportunities there?
Yeah, maybe just a couple points on real estate. I kind of joke that real estate is still one of those asset classes that's unloved, you know, since COVID. Pretty much everything in the world is expensive other than certain sectors in the, you know, in the real estate market. And a few areas as we go into the year that we're, you know, excited about. You know, one is the fact that home affordability is at an all-time low. Only 21% of people are first-time buyers. You know, that's the lowest that number has been in decades. And I think the median age of a first-time home buyer is something like 40 years old. So, you know, we see lots of opportunities in, you know, single family for rent and kind of the entire residential, you know, residential market, logistics. And when you look at kind of what's going on, what's gone on over the past couple decades around e-commerce, massive amount of construction in warehouse and storage and very little construction in new manufacturing, particularly manufacturing that requires kind of higher power wattage. Mm. If you take a 2,000 amp factory versus a 4,000 amp factory, the return on that is almost 3x of the, you know, 4,000 over the 2,000. So this is kind of leads into the next theme, which is the electronification of kind of everything and kind of increased power demand, which is kind of where we're playing the infrastructure space. And, you know, what excites us about infrastructure, electricity demand is growing at, you know, 2 to 5% per year for the next 20 years. And it's been flat for the last, you know, couple of decades. And this is not just an AI story. It's really about, you know, Anton's electric car and, you know, your smart home and, you know, all the things that, you know, require power. And energy has to be reliable. And in order to create that much energy, you need to actually use renewables. So the energy transition globally is also really important. So, you know, these are all themes that we're investing in or we're really, you know, really excited about.
Great. Yeah, we clearly need massive investment in energy and energy infrastructure to meet not just the AI needs, but everything that's happening in the economy.
Yeah, the AI needs are only about a third of the demand. I mean, I know the headlines are about, you know, AI, but it's a much bigger story. And, you know, just go back to earlier this year, you know, 60 million people without power in Spain and Portugal for 10 hours. You know, energy reliability, as there's more strain on the grids, become important. You know, we want to power the data centers, not own the, you know, own the data centers.
By the way, I think that's a really good point, because at the end of the day, power is fungible. If data centers in 5 years' time, there turns out there's too many of them, power is going to be needed to build new factories, to heat homes, et cetera. It can get moved around. A data center building that's in the middle of a desert somewhere of 2,000 acres of $500 million can't get moved. So I think from a sort of an AI perspective, an AI infrastructure perspective, I think what Jed describes as sort of being the power play is probably the safest risk-adjusted way of actually playing a lot of AI stories as well.
That's an interesting insight, because there's so much focus on AI in the data centers, but maybe a little bit too much focus when we consider that some of those risks, the obsolescence risk, the kind of isolated asset type of a risk. Anton, hedge funds are getting a lot of investor interest recently. And I wrote a blog about this in the JP Morgan Asset Management website recently, but I'd love to get your perspective. What is driving the momentum within hedge funds right now, and how do they fit into a diversified portfolio as we head into next year?
Yeah, so look, we often refer to as the last decade as the alpha winter for hedge funds. And the last 2 or 3 years, this has really fundamentally started changing. And I'd say there's three main reasons. I think the first is, one, cash rates are not zero. And if you think, if you're a hedge fund, you've got long, short positions on, and a lot of your collateral is invested in cash. So if your cash rate's zero, it's really hard to, and think of risk-free rates being zero, your returns just aren't going to be that high if you're truly neutral from a beta standpoint to traditional asset classes. Right. That's no longer the case. The second is that we also have reasonably high equity volatility. almost every day we walk in. And yeah, so the more equity vol you have, the more opportunity as a hedge fund manager that you can actually make, you have a chance of actually making more money. And then lastly, the interest stock correlations right now are also very low. We can pull up stocks this year that are up 50%, but we can easily pull up also stocks that are down 40 or 50%, including some big names that many people are familiar with. That sort of dispersion means there's a lot of relative value opportunities for hedge fund managers. And look, what are hedge fund managers bringing to the table? To me, at the end of the day, they're not benchmarked, which means they don't have to own anything. If they don't believe they have a good edge or they don't have an opportunity, they don't actually have to invest their monies. And that becomes really critical. If you think of 2-3 years ago when both fixed income and equities were showing very high correlations and both sold off simultaneously, hedge funds did particularly well. So in an environment where a lot of Fed uncertainty is driving correlations between equity and fixed income to higher than historical averages, owning something in a portfolio that perhaps actually doesn't move together with both fixed income and equities can be very beneficial. And we've seen significant flows in the last 2 years into hedge funds as sort of these alpha opportunities have picked up based on those three sort of criteria.
Yeah.
I think the portfolio construction argument for hedge funds is a really strong one, and it made me think about the conversation we were just having about, you know, real estate and infrastructure. You know, you look at private credit, it's fairly highly correlated to equities,
yeah,
and or even a 60-40. But when you look at things like, you know, hedge funds, real estate, infra, much lower correlated, and really one of the reasons why you want to own privates, to kind of own something that's going to zig when other things are zagging.
Yeah, and by the way, that kind of goes back to the conversation we had in the beginning about public-private convergence. A lot of investors are thinking of equities, whether they're public or private, as a singular kind of investment continuum, and similarly with credit, whether it's public or private. And then what you really are looking for is what are true diversifiers that are left. And you start thinking real assets, you start thinking hedge funds, even things like commodities, which don't really have to act as those first two buckets at all.
Staying on that theme of diversifiers, we talked a lot about opportunities within the alternative space. We have a lot of headwinds coming into next year. Slowing labor market, maybe comeback of inflation. What are some of the things that keep you up at night in terms of those risks, and how can investors be positioned to manage those risks?
Maybe we're not going to end on a low note, are
yeah,
we?
Exactly.
Are we here? It could actually be another good year.
Yeah, it's probably going to be a good year.
No. I mean, listen. I think that you know, as investors, especially when things have gone so well for so long, you have to ask yourself what could go wrong. And I think you've kind of laid out the things that could go wrong. So what are the asset classes that you want to own, you know, if we have an inflation spike? Now, your point about rates is, like, the Fed has a lot of room to move still. So even though, what are we at, 175 basis points of cuts since this, cycle began, there's still plenty of room to move, if the economy continues to weaken. I do think it's time to be kind of taking stock about where you've actually made money in your portfolio, anything AI related. So most investors that, you know, own growth in tech and AI are kind of way up on that side of that portfolio. And this is the time of year you have to think about, okay, am I rebalancing? Where am I putting that? What am I thinking about? What am I going to own that's going to be less correlated, whether it's hedge funds, income generating assets, assets that have embedded inflation, hedges like, real estate and infra, and different sectors of the infra market, even like transport.
Yeah, I would say the other thing to bear in mind is just monitor your liquidity risk. At the end, the assets that Jed and I invest in are generally private assets and do have less liquidity than public assets. So, and it doesn't matter what wrapper we put around them, they're still generally less liquid and they're still private assets. And so be prepared to ride out volatility with private assets, and don't think that you're going to have liquidity to start moving these things around if there is a bit of a recession or a dramatic slowdown. But I think the outlook generally for us is very positive going into next year. We don't see a recession. And therefore, a lot of the underlying trends we're seeing in across most of the alternative asset classes, we think are going to be very much alive going into 2026. And 2026, at least from an outlook perspective, continues to be, from our perspective, a very positive one for alternatives, including new entrants coming into alternatives, a lot of individuals and retail entrants who haven't owned alternatives in the past, who, by the way, are going to be supportive for a lot of valuations for a lot of these asset classes as well going into 26.
Great. So positive outlook for next year, but helpful to know that there's diversifiers out there should people be concerned about what some of the headwinds might be as we come into next year. Well, really enjoyed having you on the podcast. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us today.
It's great to be here.
Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you.
That was Jed Laskovitz, Global Head of Private Markets and Customized Solutions, and Anton Pill, Head of Global Alternative Investment Solutions at JP Morgan Asset Management. To all our viewers and listeners, thank you very much for listening to the Alternative Realities podcast. You can download our recently released fourth quarter 2025 Guide to Alternatives on the JP Morgan Asset Management website at jpmorgan.com/GTA. And if you've not already done so, please subscribe to Alternative Realities on your favorite podcasting platform.
This material is for information purposes only. The views, opinions, and statements of financial market trends that are based on current market conditions are those of the speaker and may differ from those expressed by JP Morgan Asset Management or by other areas of JP Morgan Chase & Company. Any companies referenced are shown for illustrative purposes only and are not intended as a recommendation. We believe the information provided here is reliable but should not be assumed to be accurate or complete. The views and strategies described may not be suitable for all investors. This content is intended for information only based on assumptions and current market conditions and are subject to change. No warranty of accuracy is given. This content does not contain sufficient information to support investment decisions. It is not to be construed as research, legal, regulatory, tax, accounting, or investment advice. Investments involve risks. Investors should seek professional advice or make an independent evaluation before investing. The value of investments and the income from them may fluctuate, including loss of capital. Past performance and yield are not indicative of current or future results. Forecasts and estimates may or may not come to pass. JP Morgan Asset Management is the asset management business of JP Morgan Chase & Company and its affiliates worldwide.